Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology, based right here out of Santa Barbara. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. And now, a word about the sponsor of our podcast, Anchor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Dr. Newson. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to speak with you. So I understand that you actually started your career with a degree in biology. So I'm super interested to hear kind of a bit about your educational background.
Okay. So I started out taking biology and doing all science, which I loved. I absolutely loved it. I love being an undergraduate so much that when they were talking to me about doing graduate work, I was thinking, wow, I have to specialize. This is so impossible. But then I was really lucky because I got a job as a journalist making science programs for the BBC in England. And so I got to spend another 8 years or so being an undergraduate, just like skating over a whole bunch of stuff. And then I gave up the job in order to have a child. I didn't think that the kind of work I was doing was compatible with motherhood. So I gave that up. And then I wrote books and articles and made a few videos and stuff about science and medicine. And then when I was in my mid-40s and my daughter was 10, I thought I needed a career change. And that's when I did my PhD in psychology. But I was still very biologically orientated because I wanted to look at what evolution could tell us about what humans are like.
That's super interesting. Did you have a favorite BBC special that you did? Did you like have one that you were just blown away by something you were learning?
I guess the most thoughtful one I worked on was about epilepsy, because I learned through it a lot about disability and also minds and how some kind of mental change can, or some kind of physical change can have such a huge effect on the way people think and feel. And I just met so many interesting people. Neurologists are among the most interesting people in the whole world, it seems to me.
100%. Yeah, I mean, the human body and the human brain are just such complex organs that I always am constantly learning new things, and I'll never cease to be amazed by the mysteries of the human body, as I think we probably all will. So yeah, you mentioned, absolutely. You've always kind of been interested in human evolution, or was that something that like later in your career you kind of developed an interest for?
When I was little, I used to read children's Bible stories type of thing, because I kind of thought they were true. Well, I guess when you're a kid, you don't really, it's just a story, right? My dad, I think it must have been my dad who told me, oh, well, that's just a story. And in fact, humans are just like other animals. We evolved and we changed. And then he kind of stuttered to a stop because, I mean, he was an engineer. He didn't really understand any of this stuff, but he was just blathering on like dads do. And I guess it started then. And I've read about it over the years, and it was when I decided to do a PhD, it was because I was frustrated because it didn't seem like it was going anywhere. It seemed like it was going to kind of dark, confusing places, and I thought, oh, I can sort this out. So And in the course of doing my PhD, I met Pete and discovered that he was feeling on similar lines. So that's how we became married and how we became co-authors.
That's great. For me, with an anthropology background, I think having, you know, like you said, you switched to psychology to study evolution. I feel like in my mind, that's a bit of a different approach, you know, that degree, and you're looking at things with a slightly different lens. What prompted you in particular to take that lens of looking at human evolution?
Oh, so one of the things that I believe, and I don't know, maybe you'll come to believe it too, is that all these disciplines are a distraction. And that every single study of humans is biology. Humans are animals. And because we are humans, we figured out all kinds of different ways of studying one particular animal. But we're just animals. And the reason I did psychology was because I was a mother with a 10-year-old child who was in school. And I needed to go somewhere close. I couldn't just go to a university that was the best university in the field. And so I just got to know some people at a university about 30 miles away from where I lived. And they were fascinating and interesting and welcoming. And so I decided to do a PhD with them. And they happened to be psychologists. But they were the most admirable kinds of academics, in my opinion, because they didn't see themselves as members of a field. They saw themselves as members of a huge academia, you know, that were going to use any methods they could to look at interesting questions. And so, you know, it's the people you work with and the books you read that's important rather than the discipline.
I definitely can agree with that. And as I progress, I agree that sometimes we're too niched down, and like having our niche specialties definitely helps bring in, for example, like I study like human remains and osteological remains. So like, yes, that does add a different layer to the story, but I think it's really like that collaboration and that like bringing in team members and having like a holistic team where there's people from all different fields so that the team and the product that's produced isn't necessarily an anthropology product. It's, you know, about human evolution, if that's, you know, the product that you're producing. So do you feel like your degree in biology, like that original degree, has like really helped you in this field take like a more holistic approach? Because I know personally, like having that really in-depth, I mean, biology students, like I know at UCSB, they go through it. Like it is a very rigorous program, and you get such a more in-depth view of human biology. Has it helped like a holistic approach to your research?
Yeah, I think so. It helps you understand things. I mean, when they talk about the coronavirus, you can understand a little bit of that. They talk about immunology, vaccines, mm-hmm. Genetics, how much of it's genes and how much of it's, you know, nurture. I mean, all of that is really, really useful had a grounding in what in the molecular biology of cells and things like that. It sounds bizarre, but I mean, life is totally different if you study biology.
Definitely. And
I have a friend now who's got cancer, and he talked about his cancer drug, and it's a very old drug, and I remembered it because I mean they're still using very old drugs for cancer, and I explained all about it. He said, "How do you know that?" And I thought, "Oh, well, I'm a biologist." That's a great feeling.
You're also like, one day, way back when, someone told it to me and it just stuck in the crevices of my brain. Every once in a while, these random thoughts will kind of percolate their way through and say, hello, yes, you learned that several years ago.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So this is actually my first time having two guests on the podcast. So I'm sure my interviewing skills will get better as we go, but we're going to switch over and I'm going to introduce your husband, Dr. Peter Richardson. And I want to know a little bit about your educational background as well, kind of your area of expertise and what you brought to what we'll talk about next, which is the book that you both co-authored.
Well, my undergraduate degree was in entomology, and my PhD degree was in ecology. I studied lakes, plankton biology in lakes. And so I came to an interest in humans. Well, I mean, I always had an interest in humans, right? Because there are our species. But when I was hired here at Davis as a faculty member, I was hired into an interdisciplinary department. So about half my colleagues were and still are social scientists. So I was drafted to help teach a course in principles of human ecology. And I had a pretty good training in evolutionary biology and as part of my graduate and undergraduate work. The other instructor and I decided to make adaptation one of the key themes in our course. And so I knew how evolutionary biologists thought about organic adaptations as coming about. So I figured that, I'd done a little bit of reading in anthropology for a postdoctoral project I had. I knew that there were these people that called themselves cultural ecologists. It was a kind of a important subdiscipline in anthropology going back to the 30s. So I went off to the library to look up what these people had done. And I was just looking for material for a lecture on cultural evolution, basically, how do cultural adaptations come about? And what I discovered was that theory that these cultural ecologists deployed, and later came to find out there were lots of other subdisciplines and other social sciences that had similar kind of talk, but there was no real theory there. There was nothing that resembled the evolutionary biology and population genetics and subjects like that that I knew a fair amount about from biology. So at the same time, I was teaching a different course with Robert Boyd, my longtime co-author, and he and I fell to talking about this, and we finally convinced ourselves in the early 70s that there was a research project here. There were people hadn't thought harder and done enough work in the theory of cultural evolution. So we set off to lay some foundations, and there was a few other people involved in that subject matter in those days, particularly Luigi Cavalli-Sorza and Mark Feldman at Stanford, and they took a highly population genetical point of view, and Rob and I kind of blended the population genetical view with important themes in human behavior, like our tendency to cooperate in large scale social systems. So that was how I transitioned from being a bug guy to being a human guy.
And how long have you been at UC Davis?
I came here actually as an undergraduate student in 1962. Oh. So
and never left.
Well, I left from time to time, but unlike most academics, I didn't switch universities to get my PhD degree, and I didn't switch to when I became a faculty member. Succession of accidents, basically.
But it's probably fun because you've seen UC Davis, I'm sure, evolve in its own right and students throughout, you know, your time there. I think it's really cool. I had one of my first guests did their undergrad and a PhD and then taught at UCSB. And it's really cool. You really get to see all the different levels of what's going on in the school and what it's like to be a teacher. And I imagine that like going from being a student, like if I were to ever come back and teach at UCSB, I'd feel like I could relate to the student population a lot. I'd be like, oh, I remember being in your shoes as an undergraduate.
Yeah, there's that aspect to it. I made a lot of friends over the years. So it's been a comfortable place to be an academic.
That's great. Well, what I am so excited to talk to you both about, because you have just a new book out just this month entitled A Story of Us, A New Look at Human Evolution, which you guys co-authored. So just so everyone will know, you can look it up and it's available, but I will also have it linked in the episode notes so everyone can just easily click there and check out the book. But first of all, congratulations. Any type of publication is extremely impressive, but, you know, especially a large undertaking like a book, you know, in this time, very impressive to be putting that out. So I'd love to know, when did the two of you first come up with the idea for this book?
It was the first lunch we ever had together. We were at a scientific conference, and because I did my PhD late, I was giving my very first talk for my research I did as a PhD student. And I was so scared. Anyway, he asked me a question, which was a good question. He was in the audience and after my talk. And he asked me a question. It was a good question. Somehow I managed to answer it. And then afterwards, he said he liked my talk. And I practically fell at his feet because, well, he was sort of well known. And then I'd read his book and some of his papers. And anyway, so then he asked me to have lunch. And over lunch, I said, look, it's just really terrible because your book is amazing, but I didn't get, this was the book he wrote in 1985, but I didn't get to read it until I was doing my PhD and I was at a university library. And then there's this, the bookshops are full, the shelves are absolutely full of books that don't talk about the working cultural evolution. They talk about, you know, they talk about evolution, but they don't, they're missing this. And he goes, well, yeah, kind of. Welcome to my world. And we talked about it then, but that was many years. Well, it was about a year before we both realized we were getting divorced. we've been exchanging emails and stuff. And then, it wasn't actually in our marriage vows, but I think there was a tacit agreement that we'd write this book, right, darling?
Yep. I put Leslie on the Richardson Family Fellowship, as I jokingly refer to it. And her task was to write this book.
Yeah, with his help, of course.
When you're writing, did your original intention stay the same, or did it kind of evolve throughout your writing of it? Did you maybe kind of come up with new intentions or new goals as you were going through the writing process? And both of you are free to answer these questions. We can go from one to the other.
Well, it certainly evolved from my perspective, because I think when you're excited about some ideas, your first way of talking about it is to say, this is why everything else is wrong. Okay, now I'm going to tell you what the truth is. But of course, that's not the way to do it, because people really, I mean, this is my eventual feeling, is people really want to know about themselves. People want to see how things apply to their life and to them. They don't want to be told other people are wrong. They want something useful. And so eventually it came about that it seemed to be that it should be a story of us, how, you know, a replacement for that story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden or whatever, a story which teaches people about what people are like based on where we came from, and gives you something exciting in your history that goes back years. Anyway, your turn, darling, what do you think?
I have all the wrong instincts to write a book with broad popular appeal. I think too much like a scientist. I tell long convoluted stories that are full of facts and as one of my friends described my 1985 book, he said, I used that as a sleep aid for years. he'd read at it when he couldn't go to sleep. So teaming up with Leslie, who's done popular science writing, was a really important thing. And in particular, she came up with this idea to have this three-layered book. We'll find out how well it sells. Maybe it'll be a flop, but it's, as far as we know, it's pretty innovative. So stylistically, it's got these, as you know, it's got these what I call science fiction stories. Each chapter leads off kind of with those stories. And then we recount the evidence that we think buttresses that particular story, why we wrote the that account the way we did. There's lots of interesting things we know about the human past, and so the story is certainly constrained by those facts, by the stones and the bones, to thinking of the deeper past. And and then the third section is the notes, which are which include not just the references in the usual sense of a bibliography, but there are a series of sort of mini essays about topics there that are probably not of much interest to the average reader, at least readers we hope to attract, but they hash out issues that are of interest to our scientific colleagues and competitors, and so they're meant for the. I wrote most of the notes, and they're for my our scientific colleagues, not for the general reader of the book. Although if people are interested, they can certainly read them. So we'll see how well this three-layered structure for a scientific book appeals to. We'll find out who it appeals to, if anybody.
Well, I think let's be a bit more positive. We know it's going to appeal to people. I mean, the two of you were kind enough to give me a rough draft of the book a couple weeks ago to look over, and I am truly enjoying it. I think it does a wonderful job of hitting that multi-level audience, just like you were talking about, where, you know, it has the stories, but it also, you can go to the references and you can break down, you know, that work if you want to further. But so the book really frames human evolution and early humans in this really unique way that hasn't been done before. So you position your story so that the reader can imagine themselves as an early human. And then there's a narrated story that frames each chapter of the book. And the stories are actually written in the second person perspective at each level of the jump in hominin evolution. So from chimpanzee to Homo erectus to Homo sapiens, there's a story that starts at birth and shows how an early human would have grown up and learned culture from its family. Then they follow these stories by breaking down.
Can I just say something quickly? I just have to break in, sorry. Not from chimpanzee, from an ape.
Oh, yes.
From an ape.
Yes, right, from the common ancestor.
The common ancestor.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's a wonderful correction.
It is the case that so much of what we imagine about that last common ancestor is based on what we see in the chimpanzee, because the chimpanzees still live in the same sort of environment as mm-hmm. the last common ancestor. So, I mean,
there are key differences, though.
A lot of similarities.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just don't know what they are.
Yeah, well, I know.
We know that there are differences not yet. Between chimpanzees and us, but we don't know about that last common ancestor.
Yeah, well, and then there are bonobos that are equally closely related to us, and their social behavior is rather distinctive from the common chimpanzee. So there's a lot of wiggle room in what the last common ancestor might have been like. We can't rely on the chimpanzee or the bonobo being exact models or even very good models. The last common ancestor might have been pretty weird by comparison with the other apes.
Definitely.
But one thing I think that we can say with pretty much confidence is that 7 million years ago, our ancestors would have had a typically ape kind of way of raising their children, which would have meant that mothers had to work like hell because ape babies are very, very hard to raise, it may be 3, it may be 4, it may be 5 years after they're born, they're still dependent. Even after they can forage for themselves, they still need to hang around their mother because there's still a lot to learn. She can still protect them socially, if not actually from the physical dangers around. It's an extraordinary job being an ape mother, and humans ended up doing it, being parents in a totally different way, and that's one of the things that seems to be important to us anyway.
Definitely. I just want to quickly, I'm just going to go back to, because I want to encourage our listeners to read it, because I think that they need to. So they're really framing each chapter by the story that starts at birth and then shows how these early human ancestors would have grown up and learned culture from the family. And then, as you were saying, you follow those stories by breaking down and analyzing the research and data from archaeological sites and find, which contextualize the story wonderfully without being too in your face, like only an academic can get through it. But I think one of the things that I found super interesting was how each step of human evolution was learning culture. You really focused on that and how it was being passed from the mother, or if they were learning from the other apes or humans that they were seeing. I thought that was super, super fascinating. Were there things that you kind of came across in the research that were new to you about human evolution, new facets of the way that they were adapting and learning culture?
Well, I guess the Ice Age humans are the ones I learned a lot about. Pete suggested that I read this one paper, and having read that paper, it just gave me so much imagination, because there was an extraordinary leap in cultural complexity from time 100,000 years ago, when almost all our ancestors were living in Africa, and then 50, 30,000 years ago, when humans had left Africa, mm-hmm. and were living all over Eurasia and had also made it to Australia.
Yeah. And developed advanced technologies and art, right, and art form.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's extraordinary. And so reading about that and thinking about it and thinking about some of the things that psychologists were talking about, how cooperation is developed, can be nurtured between people, getting this idea of a social tool, like a ritual where everybody does something together. It could be having a cup of tea together. It could be, you know, singing a song together. There could be so many things. And that it gives us a feeling of kinship. So it's a social tool. Money is a social tool because it allows us to trade. And that the invention of these social tools was really important for our evolution. So I suppose that was a leap forward to me. I don't know if that makes sense. Sorry.
No, that definitely makes sense. You mentioned that, you know, humans really did family life differently than other ape species. And a lot of that is the males. So in, I believe, the first two stories with the ape ancestor and Australopithecus, in the story, yeah. They bring up, you know, oh, the males visited, or the males were at a distance and they would come to mate, versus when we get into humans, you know, the men are part of raising the child. They're part of hunting for the family. Could you kind of further explain some of that to our listeners who may not be as familiar with it? For example, you know, I've read it, but I want to give them like that sneak peek into it.
Okay. Well, it's just that it starts with the size of the brain. With humans, people and their babies started to have much bigger brains. With the early humans, in the early stages, they were maybe only 10, 20, 30% bigger, but they were bigger. And it's very, very, very hard to raise a large-brained infant. They're very hungry. Because that brain requires so much energy to work. It's a very, very busy organ. And so the question is, how could that happen? When ape mothers are working as hard as they can to raise these large-brained infants, how can they then raise an even larger-brained infant? And the only answer to that question has to be that they had help from men, because the men are the only ones who aren't doing anything. So instead of, you know, fighting and doing one of the things that males do in other species, men were working and they were helping with the family. So good on men.
That's a pretty rare thing in mammals. Most mammalian males are completely useless as far as raising kids is concerned. They fight amongst themselves over access to the women, and that's about all they do, aside from look good and make a nuisance of themselves.
They also sometimes help with maintaining territory.
They do some when they're social at all. Yes, they do something.
So my next question is, I really loved, and I mentioned it before, how it's clear, the book's clearly targeted for a multi-level audience, which is something I try to do on the podcast. And as I've, you know, now been doing it for about 8 months, I've started giving more background and context and explaining certain key terms that in the beginning I was just assuming everyone knew. So why in creating this book, was it so important for you to target that multi-level audience and have it be available to people outside of academia?
I'll answer this first.
Okay.
Because people talk about evolution all the time. I mean, they're all the time talking about, you know, some idea of, oh, this is human nature, this is the way humans evolved, we're animals really. And so if everybody's talking about it, I'd really like them to talk about it from a position of a bit more knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just enough that that scientists interested in evolution talk among themselves, because people care about it. That's my answer. What's your answer, darling?
Well, it seems to me that books like this, trade books, are also how scientists in different disciplines talk to one another. People like Stephen Jay Gould have had an outsized impact on people's ordinary people's thinking, but also social scientists, for example, very frequently. Particularly in a generation earlier when Steve was still active, they got all of their knowledge of evolution from Stephen Jay Gould, or most of it. And Gould, for all of his brilliance, was pretty eccentric. I mean, he didn't represent mainstream evolutionary biology at all. Steven Pinker's another example. There are many who had an outsized influence because they've written books that are accessible to people who aren't evolutionists, other social scientists, other biologists. So in a way, a book like this, put it differently. We're all lay people with respect to lots of disciplines, right? No matter how mm-hmm. well steeped we are in anthropology or evolutionary biology or whatever. Leslie knows a lot more cell biology and biochemistry than I do, even though I took courses 40 years ago, 50 years ago. So it wasn't my specialty. So my knowledge was partial and way out of date. If I want to gain some information about those topics, I have to go back to square one. And so I think that trade books have an outsized influence on the science itself. It's not just a matter of communicating with lay people, but with your scientific colleagues.
Definitely. I could also see, like, I know my parents read to me a ton as a kid. I could see this being something that, you know, a parent reads to their child at night, even if it's just the story part, you know, the stories, just to get them thinking and interested about, you know, their common ancestors. And I think that a better understanding of evolution as a whole can really help bring, like you were saying, Leslie, a point of some actual knowledge into the discussion of race, because, you know, really the race is constructed idea. There is one race, the human race. We all originated out of Africa. And I think seeing that and reading that in a really digestible and understandable way that connects, you know, also there are few books that connect all of the steps of human evolution. You know, there's so much and there's so many changes, like we were saying, from that first common ape ancestor all the way to Homo sapiens sapiens. There's so much adaptation that happened. And I think that it really can help you understand why different populations look or act or have different adaptations. It's really just because of environmental changes or social pressures, you know, stuff like that. I think it's a really powerful tool to be able to read this book and then come out of it with some actual knowledge that you can apply to your daily life.
Well, one of the things that I think maybe the most controversial thing about our book is that we say that there's this huge important transformation happening now. And that's because we are no longer mostly living within families. Remarkably recently, like, you know, 300-400 years ago, mostly people were living in little small villages and mostly hanging out with their family or family friends. And they were really close-minded. They couldn't read, they couldn't write. And there's just been this explosion of connectedness. I mean, it's part of what humans are, is to be connected to other humans. But what we're having now is we're tackling vast amounts of information coming to us from many, many sources. It's because of our ability now to empathize with people in Yemen, people in Lebanon, that and people in Africa and people on the streets of American cities who are being harassed by police. It's because of that ability to have empathy so widely. I mean, that it's changing culture. I mean, I 300, 400 years ago, I don't suppose our ancestors cared anything what was happening in these other parts of the world that they perhaps not even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
But we're now so connected, and that in itself is having a huge effect. And one effect is that people aren't having that many children. I mean, you know, by the end of this century, the population of humans on the earth is probably going to start to decline. And we need to kind of get our heads around that idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
I saw an article the other day that was emphasizing that during COVID, like, there have been decreases in births and how dangerous that is. And when I saw the title, I thought, wait, that's a good thing. we shouldn't be having 5 kids each. Our earth is deteriorating. But they were, you know, they were framing it in the context of, like, Medicare and, you know, paying taxes and stuff. But my thought was, from a human perspective, like, it's actually probably a better thing to move back into smaller, like, bands of people. But that's my opinion. I also just am very passionate about environmental issues. And it's actually something I wanted to bring up because, Leslie, you asked me when we were emailing, you know, you said what I think are good techniques for sharing anthropological knowledge and ideas with the wider public. And, you know, I don't have all the answers. I think my podcast is kind of my first, like, dipping my toes into that. And I'm really, really happy because I've been able to give some, like, guest lectures to my old middle school and really see, like, that younger students, I'm talking below, like, college level, are very extremely fascinated by these subjects. And some people in this world still don't even know what anthropology is. I mean, I've met people that are in their 20s and they go, oh, what's anthropology? I've never heard of that major. So I think what really needs to be changed is implementing the studies of, like, environmental science anthropology and more global history at younger ages. I think so much about how much of my studies have overlooked South America, Africa, the Middle East, and how I would love to learn more about how cultures adapted there and how the people, you know, developed their livelihoods there. But it is so commonly overlooked. Lots of times in America, we focus on America. We focus on the continent of North America. We focus on Europe, sometimes like Asia. But I think really we need to start from a younger grades. You know, let's start when they get in school, teaching about environmental studies, about the human race, you know, human origins. I don't think we should be trying to start those things like at the end of high school or in the beginning of college. I mean, I only learned about the various like hominin species, I think maybe my sophomore or junior year of high school. I wish that was something that I would have been learning about from the beginning, because then I think too, when you do take like biology, chemistry, even geography, it makes more sense because you have like that prior context. So I think that's how I feel, you know, in regards to how we can begin the process of sharing anthropological knowledge, you know, with a wider public. But I'm definitely really curious to hear what the two of you think about that as well.
I totally, totally agree with you. I think a really important thing that we need to keep in mind when teaching our kids anything is that you shouldn't teach them anything they have to unlearn later. And one of the things that I find bad about this concentration on what's around them, you know, American kids learn about America, English kids learn about England, and so on, is that they have to unlearn the fact that they're just a small part of a very mm-hmm. big world, which is part of a very big universe. I think it would be good to help kids from an early age have a feeling of humility and awe about the hugeness about it. 100%. What about you, darling?
Well, I think maybe you ought to, thinking about the future, you ought to extract those stories from our book and make them into a illustrated kids book that tries to explain human evolution just strictly through those stories without. So as Gabby said, she can imagine people reading those stories out of our book like a chapter book for their 10, 12 year olds. So maybe we ought to, or you ought to, it's not my genre. You're the one who writes for the popular audience and for kids. So maybe we ought to, or you ought to get ambitious in that direction.
I think we might've just found your next project.
I don't want to give listeners the idea that this is a kid's book though.
Oh, no.
No, well, it's no.
I read some of my best books. When I was in high school, I read so much. I just devoured books, and I think that we underestimate how much teenagers even are really, really interested in what's going on around them.
Books are such a powerful way to learn. Sorry, go ahead, Peter.
Well, I learned a lot and was influenced a lot by science books when I was in high school and even younger. I mean the earliest anthropological thought that ever entered my head, I guess, I must have been 10 or 11. I read some, it's completely lost to me now, it was some series of books or a bunch of chapters in a single book, I don't even remember, but it was about North American Indians and their resistance to European domination. And it made heroes out of all these guys and sometimes gals, and that stuck with me to this day.
So do you think that A Story of Us would be interesting and useful to first year anthropology students as a way of introducing the whole thing to them? I don't know.
Definitely, I could see it as like one of the books that they recommend for like intro to biological anthropology, or I suppose archaeology as well. But I know my bioanth class at UCSB was very based on subjects relating that to that, especially because you talk a lot about adaptations and how each adaptation like came about. I think for intro to biological anthropology class, especially because those intro classes are so large, it's hard to really engage with material. I think having like reference books that aren't like textbooks for classes like that are great. I mean, for my Peoples of the Ice Age class, we had a book of The Cave Painters by Gregory Curtis, and it's really helped me further engage with these thematic ideas like in a different way. It focused specifically on the Upper Paleolithic cave art like Lascaux, Altamira, but it was really interesting to connect all of the, you know, archaeological themes that we'd been learning in class to that book. I really had this deeper appreciation for it that I don't think I would have had if I would have just read it independently of the class. Listeners, thank you so much for listening. I will have Leslie and Peter's information in the episode notes so you can check out their other research. You know, they're both very accomplished in their fields. This is by no means, you know, their only publication, but also check out A Story of Us. Again, we'll have that linked in the description. Thank you both for talking with me today.